Researchers at Dartmouth College recently found high levels of arsenic in rice. NPR's Nancy Shute is covering this story. She's in our studios. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Steve.
And, of course, she also follows this story on our food blog called The Salt. So why would there be arsenic, a poison, it's what we know it as anyway, in rice?
You know, Steve, this is a surprise to a lot of us. It turns out that arsenic is naturally occurring in soil and water, and rice plants seem to have this special ability to soak up more arsenic from the environment than other plants. So it's just there naturally.
This has been happening for thousands of years, though. I mean, people have been eating rice for a long time.
That's right. We're not talking about enough arsenic to poison you. We're talking about low-level exposure that over time might increase your risk of cancer, heart disease, maybe diabetes. So that's what the health folks are concerned about here.
Any particular difference between brown and white rice?
You know, some studies have found that brown rice might have a bit more, probably because it hasn't been polished. And, you know, some studies have said maybe basmati has a little less. But the problem is we really still don't have enough information to be able to say, okay, this rice has less, this rice has more.
Well, maybe that's the answer to the next question. Any particular difference between organic and non-organic rice?
No, there's no difference in the amount of arsenic in organic versus non-organic.
What got scientists thinking about this to begin with?
There has been problems in Bangladesh where there's high levels of arsenic in water, and they've been able to document more health problems there. And recently, that's got the scientists looking in other places, too. They're also concerned because in the United States, in the past, we used arsenic in pesticides on cotton. Some of those areas are now growing rice, and that might boost the amount of arsenic in our rice here, but we really don't know.
Okay, so we're talking about naturally occurring arsenic that gets concentrated by the plant. There may be circumstances where there's also been pollution that puts more arsenic in the soil and it gets even more concentrated by the plant. That's what we're talking about.
That's exactly right.
Does it also get concentrated even more because we're talking in many cases about processed foods like rice bars for children, that sort of thing?
Exactly. That's what the Dartmouth researchers found out. They looked at products that would have maybe three or four different rice products in it, the brown rice syrup, rice flour, and those foods seem to have more arsenic in them. It wasn't concentrated so much as there's just more stuff there. The scientists are also concerned about foods for babies. Very often we feed babies rice cereal and things like that. And children are growing quickly. Their bodies are small. The British said 2 years ago, don't feed kids rice milk because they might be getting more arsenic than you'd like.
The United States has not said the same thing?
We have standards for arsenic in drinking water, but we don't have standards for arsenic in food.
Should I be terrified?
The scientists say not terrified, but cautious. And they said two things. One thing we can do is steer away from some of these foods that might have four or five different rice ingredients. Another thing is that, sure, go ahead and eat rice, but when you do, you know, mix it up. Maybe have rice, but then have some other foods too. Just vary your diet.
So the bottom line is there's always been arsenic in rice, tiny, tiny, tiny amounts of it. And the key is moderation. Just don't get too much of it at any one time.
That's right. The FDA is sampling rice around the United States now and doing a study. We expect to have the results of that sometime this spring. And we'll be covering that in NPR's food blog, The Salt.
Nancy, thanks very much.
Thank you, Steve.
That's NPR's Nancy Shute.
Charlotte Silver's childhood was, as she describes it, rich. Rich with food, rich with experiences, rich with odd and wonderful people. She grew up in her mother's restaurant, Harvard Square's Upstairs at the Pudding, a somewhat glamorous upbringing, complete with foie gras and its own ghost. She's written a memoir of that childhood. The book is called Charlotte au Chocolat. And Charlotte Silver joins me from our studio in New York. Thanks for being with us, Charlotte. Welcome to the program.
Oh, thank you so much, Rachel.
So I want to start out by having you describe the restaurant. It's called Upstairs at the Pudding. Describe for us what that place looked like, smelled like when you were little.
This was indeed a very beautiful building. It was a historic building above the Hasty Pudding Club, which is one of the oldest social clubs at Harvard. It was a building that was not of this era. It had a beautiful, crumbly, romantic white staircase. A food critic once described dining at the Pudding as crawling into the third segment of Brideshead Revisited. So that, I think, evokes something of the feel.
Explain what the Pudding meant to the neighborhood, to that part of Cambridge.
The Pudding was almost a kind of faculty clubhouse on any given night because it was so much part of Harvard. So you would often have famous professors and public intellectuals dining there. It was also a place where celebrities came. Every year we had the Man and Woman of the Year at Harvard, something called Strawberry Night, and that was terribly exciting.
And movie stars showed up.
Yes, movie stars would show up. So this was high glamour. It happened in the middle of February, just the dreariest time of the year in Cambridge, Massachusetts. And everything would become terribly glamorous when, you know, Ella Fitzgerald and Harrison Ford showed up.
Wow.
But it also was a place that people in the community went to celebrate anniversaries, birthdays, or just to have a lunch, you know, a cozy lunch and have a bowl of my mother's red pepper soup, which was a very luscious soup. And it was definitely the kind of restaurant where everybody knew your name, as they say, very much a communal spirit.
You know, you write about how the restaurant is divided culturally between the back of the house and the front of the house. From a child's perspective, I wonder, what did that tell you about how the world operated?
My mother has a line in the book where she says that the world is divided into two kinds of people. You're either a front room person or a kitchen person. And sometimes when I was growing up and she was at all mad at me at any given time, she would say, "You're just a front room person," because to her mind, she was so much a kitchen person and they were superior.
Because the kitchen people actually did the work in the trenches.
Yes. I mean, everyone does the work in the restaurant business, and it's a very rigorous business. But kitchen people, I think, prefer to be behind the scenes. And front of the house people prefer the theatricality and the showmanship of the front of the house.
But interesting, your mom thought of herself as a back of the house kind of woman. But you describe her, she's standing in the kitchen wearing like leopard heels. So she's got her own sense of showmanship and theatrics.
Yes, I'm so glad you touched on the leopard pumps. My mother, in fact, in the book, is referred to by one of the male line cooks as Patton in pumps. Patton meaning the famous general. But yes, it is true. My mother very much, I think, straddled both worlds of kitchen and front room. And there was always a sense in my childhood of, you know, transitioning into a party dress and being on and being ready to meet the customers.
I mean, you really were thrust into the role of an adult a lot earlier than a lot of kids are, because you were alone a lot. There is this kind of lonely sensibility throughout the story. Your parents split, you see your dad sometimes, and your mom, sometimes this isn't the most flattering portrait. She's preoccupied with her work. She has a steely demeanor, and you are left to fend for yourself a lot.
It's so interesting because when I look back on my childhood now at the age of 30, I just turned 30, I'm struck with a sense of incredible richness and gratitude. And what I mainly think about is not that I was alone or not that I became an adult at an earlier age than I should have. What I think is that was a beautiful, gorgeous, glittering world, and it's lost now. And I think I had so much fun. I think those grown-ups were so much fun. The food was so delicious. I miss my party dresses. I miss those candied violets.
Has your mother read this book?
She hasn't read it, but has been enormously supportive all the way through.
Why do you think she hasn't read it yet?
My mother's a very forward-looking person, and there's a wonderful line where she tells me at a very young age that I'm at the age where I ought to be more interested in the future, and she's at the age where she ought to be more interested in the past. Huh. So I feel that not reading the book is perhaps emblematic of the kind of Patton in pumps mentality of marching forward and not looking back.
She doesn't spend a lot of time kind of dwelling on that chapter.
No, she doesn't.
Charlotte, did you ever consider going into the restaurant business?
No, I never have considered going into the restaurant business. Again, I'm a front room person.
Charlotte Silver joined us from our studios in New York. Her book is called Charlotte au Chocolat. Charlotte, thanks so much for talking with us.
Oh, thank you, Rachel.
You're listening to Weekend Edition from NPR News. From wheat in a gene bank, we move now to the bread aisle in your local grocery store. A big part of America's story is baked right into the loaves you see on the shelves, or so says our next guest, Aaron Bobrow-Strain.
I'm just a an enormous bread geek, I'll admit it.
He's also written a new book all about white bread. Yes, we know what you're probably thinking.
Bleached white.
That doesn't taste like anything.
Just kind of fakeish.
Wonder Bread. The bread that my grandfather likes. I love him, but he's terrible taste in bread.
That was Jeff Grosbeck, Carinthia Gerald, Carol Liegard, and Sarah Taylor, shoppers at a Washington, D.C. supermarket on white bread's current reputation. But Aaron Bobrow Strain, who teaches food politics at Whitman College in Washington State, says,
the invention of sliced bread was really the culmination of a long process in which bread was engineered and designed to look like a streamlined modern wonder, like an edible piece of modern art. And a lot of the impetus behind it comes out of well-meaning social reformers and food reformers who were concerned about the state of America's bread at that point.
Before the 1920s, it was women in the home and immigrants in small corner bakeries who made the majority of America's bread. It was a time when food production was unregulated and there were a lot of foodborne diseases. The era gave rise to something called the Pure Foods Movement and factory-made bread.
There was a good 20-year period at the beginning of the 20th century of moral panic, real fear about the fact that the country's staple bread was being touched by the hands of these presumably diseased and scary new immigrants.
Hmm.
And so choosing a bread from a shining white, gleaming, sparkling modern factory was in many ways a choice that people made to try to protect themselves from what was perceived as a threat, a danger. And a lot of this is wrapped up in anxieties about America's changing racial makeup with the arrival of darker-skinned Eastern and Southern European immigrants.
One of your last chapters is titled How White Bread Became White Trash. And you cite the countercultural revolution beginning in the 1960s as really the turning point for white bread status in American culture.
The 1960s counterculture took up white bread as an emblem of everything that was wrong with America. It was plastic, corporate, stale. It wasn't a particularly new idea in that sense. They were reviving ideas that food gurus had been talking about in the United States since the 1840s. But there is this idea that eating whole wheat bread was both healthy and morally virtuous, kind of an edible act of rebellion. But by the 1970s, we see that big industrial bakeries figure out ways to capitalize on this and make money off that rebellious spirit. And so by the 1990s, with the what I would call the artisanal bread baking boom, we see bread going from being a manifestation of a kind of a grassroots food activism to being a high-end niche product.
Hmm. So what did you learn? You spent an awful lot of time thinking about white bread in particular and how our perception of it and bread in general has changed over the years. What has stuck with you out of this project?
I think my message, what I learned in the end, is that those of us who want to change the food system, we need to let go of our obsession with individual food choices, right? The idea that what we need to do is to make sure we're eating the right thing and then educate and empower other people to do that as well. A lot of people talk about our food system today as being broken because we're eating the wrong things.
Mm-hmm.
And I think there's some...
Including white bread, you would
including
say.
Including white bread. And there's obviously a lot to be said for that approach. But I'm trying to, with this book, trying to make the conversation to be about a little bit more than just what we eat, but also the architectures of power that underlie our industrial food system and maintain our industrial food system.
Can we also talk about price, too? Because when you're in the supermarket and you're making a decision about what loaf of bread to buy, the artisanal 7-grain bread is going to be a lot more than the package of white bread sitting on the shelf. And if you're strapped for cash, especially these days, maybe you go with the white bread.
That's right. And I think a lot of white bread manufacturers are hoping for that because their business has been hard hit in recent years. And I, you know, it's sad to say, but as I see our country becoming more and more unequal in many ways, I suspect that the bread market will continue to segment and become unequal and divided in just the same way.
Although I got to say, if you're having a grilled cheese sandwich, you have to have it on white bread. That's just me.
Absolutely. I'll tell you, about a month ago, I made a sandwich that had kind of garlicky braised kale with Manchego cheese, a fried egg, and I did it on grilled Wonder Bread, and it was fabulous.
Sounds delicious. Aaron Bobrow-Strain teaches food politics at Whitman College in Washington State. His new book is called White Bread, A Social History of the Store-Bought Loaf. He joined us from our studios in New York. Aaron, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you, Rachel.
You're listening to Weekend Edition from NPR News. Now to a couple stories about food and what it says about the people who make and consume it. First, this past week, scientists placed thousands of small packages of grain, mostly wheat and barley, in an underground storage vault on a remote Arctic island. That vault holds a growing collection of seeds from all the different kinds of crops that people around the world grow for food. As NPR's Dan Charles reports, each of those seeds also represents the culture and history of the people who grow it.
That vault is inside a mountain on a group of islands called Svalbard. It's legally part of Norway, but it's way up in the Arctic Ocean, just 600 miles from the North Pole. Carrie Fowler was there in the darkness and wind and cold to see this latest shipment of seeds arrive. He's director of the organization that runs the vault, the Global Crop Diversity Trust.
We got 25,000 samples, about 500 seeds per sample, from really all over the world.
Collections like this are sometimes called gene banks because they're supposed to preserve part of the world's botanical gene pool. In this case, all the varieties of corn or peas or tomatoes that have disappeared from farmers' fields. They disappeared because farmers turned to a handful of varieties that promise bigger harvests and more profits. But Fowler says the old ones may have genetic traits that we will need someday to fight off diseases or cope with a changing climate.
The seeds that we have up here in Svalbard are the last remnants of these varieties. If those seed samples are lost in some way, then it's extinction for that particular variety.
Every seed that arrived this week has its own story. There's barley that came to the U.S. from Poland in 1938, a plant called amaranth collected from a small farm in Ecuador, South America, in 1979. Also, the first seeds from Tajikistan, a small mountainous slice of the former Soviet Union, just north of Afghanistan. To find out more about those seeds, I got in touch with Alexei Morganov. He's a Russian, but he lives in Turkey now and works for CIMMYT, an international research center devoted to corn and wheat. I reached him using Skype. When you go to Tajikistan, Morganov says, you see something you cannot find most other places. Farmers still planting and harvesting all the traditional kinds of wheat, the same kinds their ancestors have grown for thousands of years.
People don't want to give up growing them.
They don't want to give up the traditional wheat, Morganov says, because those varieties have the taste and texture they want.
To prepare especially a homemade bread.
Homemade bread from homegrown wheat is the centerpiece of life in Tajikistan, Morganov says. People there get half of their calories from it. And when they leave home, they're likely to take some along.
They always bring this homemade bread to me.
Is that right?
They take a plane from Dushanbe to Istanbul with Turkish Airlines, and they know there is breakfast and drinks and bread. They still take a couple of, flat breads with you just in case.
Morganov says plant breeders like him have changed their tune about the old varieties in recent years. A few decades ago, they'd encourage farmers to replace them with modern, more productive kinds of wheat. Now, he says, he's more likely to work with those older wheat lines, improving them using traditional techniques, but keeping as much as possible. The idea is to preserve them in the fields and not just in gene banks. Dan Charles, NPR News.